I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's February 13th, and we have a lot to talk about. And one of the topics that so many of you have told me you're interested in hearing more about is the impact of aging on MS. Quoting from the paper titled Aging and Multiple Sclerosis that was published a year ago in the clinical neurology journal The Lancet, quote, "The factor that is most relevant and strongly associated with the clinical course of multiple sclerosis is chronological age," end quote. But as an individual continues to have birthdays and their chronological age continues to increase, there are a lot of other biological processes taking place and changing in their body. And MS tends not to make any of that any easier. I'll agree with all of you who have told me that aging with MS is an incredibly important subject, and there's a lot to unpack here. So I'm devoting this entire episode of the podcast to my conversation with Dr. Aaron Boster, and we're going to try to cover a lot of the questions about aging and MS that you've all shared with me. Dr. Boster brings 19 years of experience as an MS clinician. He's participated in over 65 clinical trials. In fact, following its FDA approval, Dr. Boster administered the very first dose of Ocrevus in the world. And he's also known for the countless number of short videos and live Q&A sessions that he regularly hosts and posts on YouTube. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, Dr. Aaron Boster. Thanks to advancements in modern medicine, and with the exception of the heartbreaking loss of life attributed to the COVID-19 pandemic, we're all living longer. And that includes people living with MS. Aging brings with it a variety of health issues to consider, ranging from hormonal changes to the mental health impact of isolation. Aging with MS brings additional questions and concerns when it comes to living your best life. Joining me today to answer those questions and hopefully resolve some of those concerns is Dr. Aaron Boster. Dr. Boster brings 19 years of experience as an MS clinician. He's participated in over 65 clinical trials. In fact, following its FDA approval, Dr. Boster administered the very first dose of Ocrevus in the world. And he's also known for the countless number of short videos and live Q&A sessions that he regularly hosts and posts on YouTube. It's my pleasure to once again welcome you back to the podcast, Dr. Boster.
Thanks for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Just over 30 years ago, there were no medications to modify the course of MS, and today there are over 20. With more people starting treatment early in the disease, has this impacted how MS progresses and how people are aging with MS?
I think it has. Anecdotally, any MS neurologist who has been delivering care for some time makes the same comment, which is the waiting room looks different. And so if you go back a generation or two, the waiting room was full of people who required assist devices, wheelchairs, gurneys, et cetera. And the modern MS waiting room doesn't look like that anymore. You know, the earliest application of the most effective medicines really changes the natural history of the disease, and which is a good thing. And it's really changing the frequency of MS attacks and the progression of disability.
Well, I think you may have started answering my next question. I'll ask it and we can continue the conversation. Most people living with MS are diagnosed between the ages of 20 and 40, 45. But the average age of someone living with MS is actually between 55 and 65. And 15% of the people living with MS are over the age of 65. I'm wondering, what differences do you see between younger people with MS and older people with MS?
So the first disclaimer of the evening, we're speaking in generalities, of course, and there's exceptions to all the rules. But if we speak in generalities, someone who has a younger chronologic age is more likely statistically to experience MS attacks, clinical attacks, and have new enhancing lesions on their MRI. As the human being ages, they are statistically less likely to have attacks in new spots, but they are more likely to experience a progression of disability independent from attacks. And so if you look at a group of 20-somethings with MS and a group of 60-somethings with MS, what you'll see is the 20-somethings are having much more acute bouts of inflammatory activity, and the 60-somethings are having less of that, but more progression of disability.
MS causes variable symptoms. So does aging. I'm hoping you'll talk about some of the common mental and physical changes associated with aging that can be similar to or even mimic some of the symptoms of MS, and maybe share some tips on how people living with MS can monitor what's going on in their body so they can tell the difference.
You ask the best questions, and that is really on the pulse of this issue. You bring up a really important point, which is sometimes it's hard to sort out. Am I having trouble doing X because I'm older than I used to be, or is it because of my condition? And that can be downright frustrating, both for the patient and the partner, the family, and also sometimes for the practitioner. So if we try to unpack it a little bit, if you look at, and let's just talk about someone who's 65 years old, just for the sake of the discussion. And with someone who's 65 with MS, when they talk about fatigue or they talk about forgetfulness and they bring it up to their friends invariably say, "Oh, me too, honey," or yeah, me too. You know, it speaks to this fact that as we age, we can see changes. How do you sort it out? One way is to compare the human being, the patient that we're taking care of, to how they performed last year. Because we're really not trying to directly compare to thousands of other people. We're trying to help you live your best life. And so if you weren't needing an assist device and now you are, I think we're going to have to take that in consideration. Now, if it's because of aging, what does that mean? Are you deconditioned? Is there a value in physical therapy to rehabilitate, right? Do you have other concerns? Are there pulmonary concerns or orthopedic concerns which are interfering? And we try to pick apart the things that are modifiable, independent, bluntly, as to whether or not they're because of an MS progression of disability or you're just getting older. Because at the end of the day, we're just trying to help you live your very, very best life. I want you to walk as far as you choose to walk. And I don't want MS or, quote, older age, end quote, to be the reason that you can't. If we think about for a second, like tips and tricks, I'm going to sound like, you know, something your mom would say, because your mom was right. Eating a healthy diet is massively underappreciated in the MS population. And I think that becomes more, not less valid as we get older. Getting restorative sleep, and I underline the word restorative, is paramount to success with this condition. And most red-blooded Americans don't. We budget for 5 hours of sleep and we snore through all of it and wake up 3 times to pee and we're wondering why we're exhausted in the morning, right? I mean, these things really can make a big difference. Exercising as part of your lifestyle is not for college kids only. And whereas you might not be able to exercise the way that you did when you were in high school, you sure as hey can do something. And so I think that it's critically important that we pay even more attention to modifiable lifestyle changes in someone as they have birthday after birthday.
As people age, as they have birthday after birthday, they're likely going to develop other health conditions. These are called comorbidities. Yep. Now, this is true whether they happen to be living with MS or not. But for those people who are aging with MS, do their comorbidities make treating their MS more challenging, or does their MS make treating their comorbidities more challenging, or is this even an issue?
So I think the answer is yes, that I think sometimes the MS can make treating the comorbid condition a challenge. And more commonly, what I see is the comorbid condition makes the neurological status worse. And let me clarify. Brain health is underappreciated. It really is. You know, we all know that it's important to keep your heart in shape, right? Like, you know, we don't want to have heart attacks, but really the health of the vessels for the brain are every bit as important as the vessels for the heart. And allowing oneself to have an uncontrolled high blood pressure or an uncontrolled diabetes or an uncontrolled high cholesterol or someone who continues to smoke cigarettes, as an example. These all of these cardiovascular risk factors, all these comorbid conditions result in a faster accelerated hardening of the arteries of the brain, a faster shrinkage of the physical size of the brain, and have been shown in people impacted by MS to cause them to become more disabled quicker. So, you know, this is a fancy, long-winded way of saying, as we help take care of someone with MS, we can't just look at the MS. We have to look at the human being, right? And if the concern is the diabetes is not under adequate control, that's what we have to address. Failure to do that is to allow them to get worse quicker than they should.
Given that disease activity seems to slow as people age, many people wonder if they can eventually go off their disease-modifying medications. So should someone who's just celebrated their 60th birthday stop taking their disease-modifying therapy?
You just asked literally like a billion-dollar question. Not a million, but like it's a very, very important question. And I'm going to try to do it justice. The real answer is we don't know. That's the actual answer. You know, just 2 decades ago, we couldn't even treat MS. Now we have some treatments and we're still trying to sort out how to use them, bluntly. And we're not sure. So the real answer is the jury's out, and there's a lot of ongoing nerd arguments amongst my colleagues trying to figure this out. There tends to be two camps. One camp are a group of neurologists that say, okay, as you age, the immune system becomes quieter, and we haven't studied the disease-modifying therapies as well in that age group, and people have increased risk as they age for cancers and infections. So maybe in someone who's stable, the better part of hours to take them off therapy. There's another camp who believes that we, as long as you have an immune system which risks attacking the holiest of holies, the supercomputer that runs the body, and as long as you have neurological features that you're fond of, whether that be seeing, smelling, having an orgasm, moving your right arm, like whatever that may be, then we want to preserve the neurologic reserve. Now, you can kind of guess which camp I fall into. I'm a firm believer that we want to treat up until death. So I don't treat after death. That's where I draw the line, John. I will not. I don't. It's never been tested. I just don't do it. But up until death, I want to treat your MS. And let me make 2 more points about this. There has been some studies done which try to answer this question. They're not definitive, but there have been studies done. And one study that really struck me looked at 55-year-old people, and golly gee, that is not old, but 55-year-old people who had relapsing MS and had been stable on therapy for 5 years. So that was the criteria. And they stopped their medicines and they followed them for a couple of years. And then they looked at how they did. And there were very, very few MS relapses, which is great. And they concluded that it was probably safe to stop medicines because only 1/3 of the patients had progression of neurological disability. Well, excuse me, if that 1/3 included my mother, unacceptable, right? And we have to remember that the widget is somebody's mom, right? So given that I can't a priori tell you, you are in the group that will be stable, or you are in the group that will progress, I think that we don't want to pull the drug away too quickly. Second point, I went to medical school and residency and fellowship. And as I reflect on my education, never was I given a course in paternalism. I was never taught how I get to pick for you your risk aversion, right? That was not a class. And I feel strongly that it's not my right to inform you that it's no longer safe for you to take a medicine. Nor is it my right, frankly, to demand that you have to do it. I feel instead that it's my ethical responsibility to educate you and then to allow you to make a decision and for me to support that decision, right? And so the reason I bring this up is if you are able to understand that the risk of an infection goes up as you get older, if you are willing to accept that we haven't tested the drugs in a certain age group, but you're tolerating the drug and it's safe to you and we perceive benefit, I want you to keep on keeping on. And I'm going to give an example. I had a conversation exactly about this topic yesterday. A gentleman that I've taken care of for well over a decade and a half, a really cool guy, just retired like a month or two ago. Okay, just retired, was working 60-hour weeks until he retired just a month ago. And he can't stand his month-long retirement because he feels like he needs to be doing more. And so he's picked up all these side projects. He travels, he drives, he's walking, he does all the things. He hasn't had an infection since I've met him. And he's receiving a B-cell depleter. I forgot to mention, he's a week away from being 80 years old. Now, I told him, I said, a lot of neurologists would throw stones at me and say, oh my goodness gracious, why are you treating this 80-year-old? To which he laughed. And the reason he laughed is he's in better shape than most people I know. And so that's simply an example. Removing his drug is nonsensical just because he happened to celebrate a given birthday. Now, I want to go back to the very first thing I said, which is the jury is still out. But anecdotally, I can tell you, I have seen with my own eyes patients that came off therapy. And it's not that they have frequent attacks, John, but they progress in their disability. They pick up a cane. They progress to a walker, and it breaks my heart. And so I am very opinionated about this topic. It doesn't make me right. It just makes me like really opinionated. But I think that we should keep on keeping on.
Depression is common among people living with MS, and the prevalence of depression can increase as people age. Yeah, I tend to bring up depression often on the podcast because it's so prevalent among people living with MS, but it's something that can be effectively treated. Depression is never a good thing, but how does depression affect the overall wellness of an older person?
So again, you touch on a critically important topic, and I want to point out a couple things. The first is that people impacted by MS are literally twice as likely to experience depression or anxiety for that matter, compared to the general population, which is an astounding number. Given that we have just weathered a global viral pandemic, to have a patient of mine who has not experienced some depression would actually be weird, like frankly, right? And to your point, we can treat depression, but there's a couple things that I really need to point out. There's very disturbing data that untreated depression can lead to MS getting worse faster. And that's very bothersome to me. I also want to point out that depression is invisible. And even though it's terribly prevalent, well, honey, you look so good. Oh, you're doing okay, right? All that nonsense. And yet it can color everything ugly. So you then add, dare I say, insult to injury, because as you pointed out at the beginning of our discussion, sometimes hand in hand with getting older is being socially isolated. So people who stop working, they may not be doing the same things within their community they used to do. That can massively contribute to depression. It bears stating that people impacted by MS are at high risk of suicide. And I've lost patients to suicide. I've lost friends to suicide. And it's a terrible, terrible thing. And we need not to shy away from it. We have to talk about it. So I think it's actually a requirement of a caring neurologist to inquire about mood with every visit, with every patient. And I think it's a best practice to get a collateral history. You know, when we're dealing with someone who's, again, we'll just keep talking about someone who's 65, they may have developed a stoicism where they've learned that they don't comment on being sad and blue. And so they may not be forthcoming. So you got to ask their husband or their wife, you know, who will rat them out. And I have found time and time again, when you treat depression, magic things happen. Literally, magic things happen. And so someone who's listening to this, who feels sad, blue, and depressed, I want to empower you. I want to advocate for you to talk to your clinician, say, hey, I think I need to address this because we can make it better. It's really important, John, like super, super important.
You know, I'm so glad you brought up social isolation. Isolation isn't a symptom, but it's often an outcome of aging, and it's often an outcome of living with MS. Perhaps more so if someone is living with advanced progressive MS that might seriously affect their ability to just get out of the house. Beyond depression, are there other health issues that could develop as a result of experiencing the kind of isolation we're talking about?
Yes. So social isolation can also lead to cognitive impairments. So the lack of adequate stimulation, cultural, intellectual, spiritual, community-based, the lack of stimulation can result in cognitive impairments. Now, people impacted by MS are already at some risk of cognitive impairments, and so we want to do everything and anything to prevent that from happening. You know, one of the things that I think might be a silver lining to the pandemic, and I hate to say that, but if there is a silver lining, one of them might be the development of robust social support networks on the interwebs. You know, there's a high likelihood that somebody listening to us right now might live by themselves, and they might be listening to this late at night when no one else is up. They may be having some social isolation, right? And so I hope that if you're listening to this and that's your situation, that you'll at least consider reaching out to one of the myriad support groups that are now ubiquitous on the interwebs, where like-minded people in a culture of knowing can get together, even if you can't leave your house. I really feel like it's an underappreciated topic and one that we gloss over way too often.
Aging brings with it hormonal changes. And I think most of us already know that men and women experience different hormonal changes as they age. Can those kinds of changes affect MS symptoms?
100%. So let's start with boys and then we'll talk about girls. So interestingly, low levels of testosterone in men with MS can cause sexual dysfunction and depression and cog fog and are associated with faster worsening of disease, which is terrifying. I routinely check free testosterone levels, morning levels, in all the gentlemen I take care of once or twice a year. And it's not uncommon that as we age, our testosterone levels ratchet down. And supplementing testosterone is remarkable. It's remarkable, not just for a gain in the bedroom or a gain in the playing field or what have you, but to confidence, to cognition, to mood. It's really, really colossal. And I think it's not done enough, in my opinion. We really need to be on point looking at gentlemen's testosterone levels. I think that's part of good care in MS. If we transition to a discussion of women, most women start to go through something we call perimenopause around, let's say, 40-ish, where their monthly menstrual cycle might start to become slightly irregular. They're not ovulating on schedule. And what's really happening is the three hormones involved in the menstrual cycle start to decrease. And typically, most women have experienced a full menopause by, on average, around, like, say, 55-ish. Menopause comes with a bunch of symptoms, and tell me if they sound a lot like MS to you. Insomnia, trouble sleeping, problems with pooping, problems with bladder, problems with sexual function, problems with cognition, problems with energy levels. I can see every single one of those in the setting of multiple sclerosis, and 2/3 of all people with MS are women. And so the other piece to this, when you look at women with multiple sclerosis who go through menopause, we see decreased attacks, but we see a risk of increased progression of disability. Now, because of risk of cancer and blood clots, it's fallen out of favor to supplement women's hormone levels. But there are ways to do it somewhat safely. For example, estrogen-only topical treatments tend not to increase cancer risk and tend not to increase blood clots and can make a tremendous difference in a woman's life, not just because of hot flashes and vaginal dryness, but because of depression and insomnia and difficulty with bowels and all the other things. So again, I think it is a important best practice to explore this with women impacted by MS. And if we identify that we think menopause is playing a role, we need to have a frank conversation with the obstetrician gynecologist. And we need to help them understand, yes, we are sensitive to the risk factors, but in this particular woman, it might be of value to supplement.
You know, as you were speaking, something occurred to me. As women go through menopause and they no longer are producing those same hormones that we were just discussing, men don't produce estrogen, estriol. They don't produce that at all. And yep. And when a man is diagnosed with MS, it's not unusual for them to have a rockier disease course, to be yep. more progressive, more symptomatic. And what you just said was, at menopause, we sometimes see more progression as they lose that hormonal protection, it sounded like.
You're spot on, John. And in fact, this has been studied. And when you look very carefully at the trajectory of progression of disability, men with MS tend to progress faster until women reach the age of menopause. Men and women catch up. Women catch up to men and progress at the same rate as they go through those changes. A very, very scary concept. It's even more scary when we start to appreciate that most OB-GYNs that I've spoken to are unfamiliar with what I'm saying. And I literally will have to send them the papers that talk about this kind of stuff because it's not part of their day-to-day, you know, work.
Are what we're saying is the reason we're not seeing more estrogen-focused disease-modifying therapy being developed is because you can't patent estrogen?
I think there might be three reasons. So one of them is what you just touched on. So in order to develop a drug, at least in the United States, there has to be something in it for the manufacturer because they will spend hundreds of millions, literally hundreds of millions of dollars in research, and they need to recoup their cost.
Right.
And it's unlikely that that might be the scenario with estrogen. So I think what you're saying is actually true, but there's two other reasons which I think play a role. Most obstetrician gynecologists are not trained to understand MS. And most MS neurologists have zero training in hormonal changes. And so you have a human being who happens to be a woman and happens to be going through menopause and happens to have MS. And here she has a well-intended neurologist that doesn't know jack about her menopause and a well-intending obstetrician gynecologist that doesn't know jack about the MS. And she's stuck in the middle. And so in the absence of adequate education, coupled with the fact that there might not be adequate money in it, we haven't seen that go very far.
Interesting. We often talk about the fact that the best treatment for MS is, quote unquote, comprehensive care, taking a team approach to MS yep. care. So I'm wondering yep. whether as someone ages, should they be adding new members to their healthcare team?
Oftentimes, I think the answer is yes, but it's an as needed, right? It's not a one size fits all. I am very fond of geriatricians. These are expert doctors, typically internal medicine doctors, who have done extra training to help people over the age of 60, 65. And they have expertise, which is needed in the United States, you know, it's needed worldwide. It's and unfortunately, there's, you know, not gazillions of them. I also will talk about something which is unpopular, and that's the profound value of palliative care. So most people, when they hear palliative care, they think of hospice. They think of someone actively dying, which is not what I'm referencing. Palliative care is a field of medicine exclusively focused on quality of life and symptoms. And whereas I hope that MS neurologists embrace the importance of quality of life, you and I both know that sometimes they're a little less attentive. If that's the situation, bringing on a palliative care team is paramount to addressing the issues that are eroding the quality of life. So these are just two examples where adding on a geriatrician, adding on a palliative care team might radically change the human's experience for the better. But I think the short and the long of it is, if we put the human, the family, at the center of our discussion, and we rally around the goal of helping them live their best life despite the conditions that they have, we're going to make the right decisions and we're going to bring the right team members to the table. Sometimes we need a physiatrist. Sometimes we need an orthopedic surgeon. Sometimes we need a darn psychiatrist. And so I think we have to be open to the idea that as things change, our needs might change and it may call for extra team members or extra village members to come to the table.
You know, there's lots of people over the age of 60 who are living with MS today, and it would seem important for a clinician to know how they might respond to a particular medication, but people over the age of 60 are routinely excluded from clinical trials. Why is that?
Statistics. So it's not a very nice reason, but it's a math reason. When you are doing a clinical trial, you're spending about $100 million per arm per year, right? In other words, if you do a trial where there's drug A versus drug B for 2 years, that's a minimum of $400 million, which is a tremendously large number. And they work out the statistics ahead of time to say, okay, if the average person with MS has an attack on average this frequently, we should enroll X number of people so we can capture this number of events. When someone with MS ages, they are statistically less and less likely to have attacks, which doesn't mean they don't have attacks, they just have them less frequently. So in order to observe them in a clinical trial, you would have to either A, enroll a bunch more, or B, run the trial longer, which is too expensive. And so what they do, they being like the clinical trial design folks, is they game out a period of time when people are most likely to have change so they can see it. So enrolling a 20-something into a trial is more, quote, attractive, end quote. I put it in quotes because I don't actually believe that, because you're more likely to see them change. Along the same lines, John, when you look at the EDSS, so that's the disability scale that we use, 6 is a cane. Most humans with MS, when they hit 6, they stay there for years. And I'm talking about the natural history of the disease. So someone picks up a cane to help them ambulate, they may be in that stage for like 10 years. And so most trials don't want to enroll people that are either using a cane or a walker because statistically they're less likely to change. It doesn't mean it's not useful to study them or that we shouldn't be helping them, because we should. It simply means that it's too expensive statistically to try to answer those questions.
Let's take the scenario you just described, accurately described. How is it likely to change in light of acknowledging things like progression independent of relapse activity? So now we understand that there is progression going on, even when someone may not be more symptomatic, even when they may not have a relapse. It's a rather new concept. How will that factor into recruitment for clinical trials or clinical trial design, for instance?
So I think that we need to do things a bit differently. Now, let's start off by saying, when we started studying MS, we really developed and studied drugs which shut down acute bouts of inflammation. So MS attacks and new spots that enhance, which is very relevant. That's fantastic. But it's not the whole kit and caboodle, right? It's only part of the disease process. And so no matter your age, the currently developed drugs are not fully adequate to control the disease. And that becomes increasingly relevant, right? So I think one of the answers to the question is we need to think about doing clinical research differently. I am increasingly enamored with using large data sets like MS-BASE is an example, or NARCOMS is an example. These are giant data sets where human beings with MS did something heroic, where they volunteer to participate in a registry, which is a lot of work. So they're constantly allowing their data to be uploaded, or they're literally filling out forms, and they're contributing to a large body of data, which can then be data mined, right? Where we can go to the data set and we can look and we can ask intelligent questions using appropriate statistics, and we can come to some conclusions. I'll give you an example. It's very desirous to know if drug A is better than drug B. Like, that would be great, right? And yet we don't have that information for the same reasons I mentioned earlier. It's too expensive. So we can turn to giant data sets like MS-BASE and answer the question, because we have hundreds, if not thousands, of people on drug A and hundreds or thousands of people on drug B. And we can use advanced statistics like propensity weighted matching to then answer the question. Now, it's not class one evidence, but it gives you an answer. And so I think that we need to divorce ourselves from the 1990s approach to MS clinical trials, and we need to be a little bit more willing to consider alternative statistical models to try to answer questions that matter. I also will, and again, this might be considered heretical, I have this crazy idea, which you're going to think is just nuts. We should listen more to people impacted by MS as they age, because they probably know what they're experiencing. And if we as clinicians, or as a community of clinicians, shut up and listen, we might learn a whole bunch of stuff.
You've certainly covered the spectrum from big data to that the individual perspective on the disease course. So yes, I think both of those provide really useful insights. One more question for you, and frankly, you have definitely started to answer this earlier in our conversation when you talked about modifiable lifestyle changes. So let me ask you, what are three things that someone over the age of 60 who's living with MS can do to optimize their well-being?
Excellent question. I'm going to try to limit it to three, but I might cheat and do like a 2A and 2B or something like that.
Feel free.
So thank you. So the first thing is we're going to be very, very sensitive to risk of death. Let's be blunt. There are three ways that people with MS die. A decubitus ulcer, a bed sore that seeds the bone and causes osteomyelitis and sepsis. Number two, dysphagia, where you swallow down the wrong tube and it goes into your lungs, aspiration pneumonia, which causes sepsis. Or three, a urinary tract infection, which seeds the blood, a urosepsis. And so those three things are always top of my mind, but they can become more relevant as we get older. So fighting against them is critically important. If you cough, choke, sputter when eating or drinking, not acceptable, not normal, not okay, get ye to the speech pathologist so we can sort out what's going on with the swallowing, because we don't want food in the front tube, only the back tube. If you have recurrent urinary tract infections, not okay, must address this. And we need someone to look at your tushy and look at your shoulder blades and look at your heels every night to make sure that we're not having skin breakdown. So I'm going to try to get away with grouping all of those into one, which is like a prevention of death discussion. The second one is to keep moving. And so exercise is a critically important aspect to lifestyle if you want to live your best life with MS, independent of age. Now, do I think that you can be a competitive, boxer in your 60s? Maybe not, right? But you can do something. And if the style of exercise that you did when you were a younger man or younger woman doesn't work, that's okay. You just have to find a different one. And so whether that be water Zumba or chair yoga, I don't care. We need to keep moving. And I could wax poetic for hours on why that's relevant. The third one is you need to stay engaged. So whether that's joining a church group, whether that's participating in a book club, whether that's writing a memoir, whether that's tutoring young people, I need you to stay an active member of your village and your community for your health. So those will be the three things.
Dr. Aaron Boster, I want to thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And once again, thanks so much for talking with me today.
It's been a pleasure and an honor. I love your podcast, and I'm really, really glad that I got to visit. Thank you again.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/337. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.